Welcome to Love at First Science, the podcast designed to dig deep into neuroscience, the human body, and anatomy. My name is Celeste. I'm a physio and I teach anatomy to yoga teachers. And this podcast is an archive of the lessons I've learned along the way in my attempt to bring a more science-based approach into the yoga world. Hey friends, thanks for tuning in. Just a quick reminder that I don't run any ads, so this podcast can only grow with your support. If you learned something new that you found useful, please do rate and review the podcast. And if you think the content can help someone get out of pain, improve their life, move without injuries, or even just feel more inspired, please share it with them. It would mean the absolute world to me, and you never know, we just might help elevate our community along the way. You know, sometimes when I look at this podcast, I think to myself, wow, it's a lot of work. Is this a good investment of my time? And then occasionally I'll get guests like Dr. Ben Ryan. And suddenly I think to myself, this is so worth it. This is worth all the time it takes to put these together for you guys because people like him give me hope for the future. He's a PhD postdoctoral researcher. He works at a lab in Stanford. He talks about science on social media. Please follow him. He's so brilliant at making things, just mind-blowing things, so easy to understand, and for giving you a unique view and unique lens through which to view the world. I'm going to be asking him some pretty deep questions today around the topic of psychedelics. I'm going to be a little bit brave and tell you all that I'm a fan of taking hallucinogenic mushrooms. I found that they've really helped me become a better person. And I want to know more about the science, like why. And that's why I decided to bring Dr. Ben here to talk about this amazing topic. This episode has been broken up into two parts, and this is your part one. So I'm very excited today because I have been following Dr. Ben Ryan for a while and I kind of messaged you being like, would you come on the podcast? Didn't think you'd even reply, but here we are. I can't believe this. Thank you so much for being on Love at First Science.
Well, it is a pleasure to be here and I really appreciate your support and I'm excited to talk about whatever we're going to get into today.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I'm a huge fan of the brain, and that's your thing. I mean, can you give us a little bit of background as to how you got into studying neuroscience?
Yeah, so there's a long story and a short story. I'll give you the short story. I was studying psychology to begin with because I was interested in why people behave the way they did. I always found that interesting. And I was afraid of neuroscience, admittedly. And I share this because it's maybe inspiring for any listeners out there who are students. I was afraid of learning about the signaling molecules and everything involved, and that really seemed intimidating to me. And then one morning I woke from the most frightening nightmare I've ever had, and I was just so fascinated by the brain. And my fascination turned from the sort of external expression of behavior and why people behave the way they do to the organ inside, because there was no behavior associated with my nightmare. I was just experiencing this unbelievable landscape in my dream, and I had to understand how that was happening. And so I started being more and more curious about the brain itself as an organ. And literally that day I woke up and I changed my major. I was in college and I never looked back. And by the way, for any students who are curious, it was perfectly fine. I have always found that when you're really motivated and interested in something, you can learn how to do anything, how to understand anything. It's all about having the motivation behind it.
And guys, this is coming from someone who studies the brain, so I'm definitely going to take that as inspiration because it's actually something I've been toying with in the back of my mind, but because I grew up with so dyslexic and found learning so hard, I'm terrified. The thought of going back to university to study, like doing a master's or a PhD, I'm like, I don't know, I'm not that good at reading.
Yeah, if you have the motivation, I mean, if there's something pushing you, you know, and I found that so many times through my PhD and even since then, there have just been times where I've really struggled with learning certain things, you know, whether it's a concept or it's an actual, like a technique in the lab. And I've just been, you know, hitting that wall where you think there's no way I can get through this. And then, you know, once you realize like, I have to get through this, my PhD depends on it, suddenly all of those walls kind of fall down and you're just able to push through. But I've also had times where I really wanted to learn something. Like I tried to teach myself how to speak Chinese. That didn't happen. That did not work.
You're a busy guy, though. Like, I think I can forgive you for not nailing Chinese just yet, but there's time, right? You're a young person. I think give yourself some space. There's always time. One of the things I listened to you saying on a different podcast was about, you kind of were speaking about yoga and mindfulness and how it's a really powerful practice. And the things that you said were so nice about it. And, you know, sometimes for the right reasons, people say kind of yoga is a practice that we should avoid. And I can understand that sometimes it can hurt people and stuff, but there's also lots of good stuff in it. And when I heard you talking about it, I thought, oh, this has to be my opening question. Have you got any insights for us about the brain and yoga?
Yeah, I'm a little bit out of touch with the exact literature, so I can't cite specifics and say this is the, you know, an effect that's been seen. But what I generally remember, it's funny because I did a video, a TikTok video, and for anyone who doesn't know, I make TikTok videos and Instagram videos about the brain and, you know, educational stuff. And I once made one about yoga and the brain and the health benefits. And as soon as I started doing the literature review, I was just completely shocked because I had always seen yoga as, I don't know, maybe like a sport, I suppose, and less of a therapy. And I was just seeing all these studies that were just remarkable. You know, they were showing improvements, if I remember correctly, in things like depression and anxiety and, you know, just overall improvements in well-being and mood. And I just found it so incredible. And I just, you know, I'm a huge supporter, and I suppose I can call myself an advocate, although I don't advocate loudly for it. But whenever asked, I mean, absolutely. I think doing things like mindfulness meditations and yoga exercises and all of these exercises that sort of take you away from whatever it is that you experience in your daily life and allow you to go internal and go to a place of calmness and comfort. And maybe if it's, you're doing a yoga exercise, you're working on your body and you're trying to, you know, you're thinking about how you, this is improving you and you're stretching and you're exercising, those moments and periods, more than moments, where you are just really relaxing and separate from the stressors of daily life are so valuable. And I think they're hard to come by for most people. And yoga offers a very powerful structure to enter those states, you know? And I think that's really, I think that is really the key of yoga and mindfulness, is just training yourself to enter a place of calm and then potentially being able to access that place later. But certainly if you're not able to access it later, I mean, at least in the moment when you're doing these exercises and you're relaxed, that is just this so, so peaceful. And I enjoy it myself. I don't make enough time to do these things, but whenever I do, I'm always like, wow, I need to do this more often.
Again, I think you can be forgiven. I mean, not only are you studying, you're studying at Stanford, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's so, yeah. Right. So pretty busy with that, but then you're also making these incredible videos. I know you mentioned TikTok and Instagram, and I just want to say a personal thank you because, again, because I always found reading so hard, I look at research literature and sometimes I do get a bit overwhelmed by what I'm looking at. And then you come along and you're like, quick synopsis, you make it really visual and really fun. So yeah, thank you for putting time into breaking down science in such an educational, fun way.
Well, I really appreciate that. Thank you so much. And I really think that science should be more clear and accessible. And like you said, you know, you don't like to reading a paper, scientific paper, is difficult, even for a scientist, even when it's your exact field of study and you understand all the stuff that's being done in the experiments and the rationale, even still, it's never easy to read a paper. And I think that is a huge flaw in science. And I think that has unnecessarily distanced the field of science from the public. And so I do what I can to just, you know, make it fun and clear and available for free. So, you know,
yeah,
I wish I had more time to focus on it.
There is those paywalls, and then there is those psychological walls that are built up. And actually, because I am an anatomy teacher for yoga teachers, I try and bring as much evidence-based foundation to what I do. And one of the questions I get quite often from yoga teachers is like, well, how do you even read a paper? And listening to you just say those words, it's hard for anyone already, is a massive boost. But do you have any tips of just like one or two things to do just to help a person who's got literally no scientific background actually gain the juice that's necessary from each piece?
Yeah, there's so much, and every paper is, there's so much to every paper, and every paper is different. Generally, I mean, for anyone, if you're interested in the finding the scientific answer to any question that you may have, personally, I'm a scientist, so this is maybe a little ridiculous for the layperson, but I go to PubMed or Google Scholar, you know, these databases where scientific papers are found. And instead of, like, when you might go to Google and you search, like, what part of the brain is activated in yoga, right? You might Google that on Google. Instead, I'll go to PubMed and I'll search, like, keywords like yoga and brain activity, and I'll just see what results pop up. And typically it's pretty good at sensing, if you put the right prompts in, it'll show you papers relevant to what you're looking for. And you can just read the abstract. And that's really what the abstract is for a quick summary, what's found. And if the abstract is well written and properly written, there should be some information about the results. It shouldn't just be, we asked this question and we did the study this way. It should say, and here's what we found. It should be a couple sentences. And if you, that hopefully that will be sufficient to give you a general answer to your question. And frankly, you know, no shame on Google, but when I do Google searches, I feel like the answers are always very strange anyways. It, like, links to a specific, like, media, like, article that doesn't really give me the answer. So you can just stick to the abstract. And then if you really want to, you can start diving in and looking at the data. And then a whole bunch more tips are unlocked that I can go there if you want, but it can become an entire lesson.
Let's maybe save that for round two. If this podcast goes viral, come on, guys, share, then we'll get you back just to give us a little tip about that. One of the things that I loved hearing you talk about as well was that this concept of a little bit more. So if you're a couch potato, at least go for a walk. And if you're someone who walks, maybe you can try and walk either further or maybe try a run. And to be honest with you, ever since I heard you say this, you've been in my head, because I'm like, right, well, yesterday I did this much on the bar, so now I've got to put in at least another 5 kgs. And so, first of all, thank you for that concept, because it's really been inspiring for me. But can you sum it up and talk about the brain? And obviously it's not just exercise, but our whole development as humans, right? Hey, my loves, real quick, if you are hypermobile, be sure to check out my book, Too Flexible to Feel Good, where my co-author and I share the latest science on how to help a bendy body feel awesome. If you already have the book, please do leave it an Amazon review. It helps more than you could ever know, and it just might help someone else feel a bit more stable in their bodies. The book is called Too Flexible to Feel Good, and you can get it from most online retailers.
Yeah, totally. Thank you so much for asking me this question, because this is something I kind of allude to often, but I've never really asked about it. So I think everybody wants to feel better than they do right now, right? And then you get to a level where you're feeling a little bit better and you kind of forget that you felt worse before. And you're like, I just want to feel better. I want to feel more alert. I want to sleep better, whatever it is. And so when it comes to setting goals and finding ways to elevate your mood and your well-being, I always say, like you said, just do a little bit more than you're doing. And usually I say that with regard to exercise. So people might say, you know, I'm really out of shape and I don't feel good and I want to get into the gym. And they set, like, unrealistic goals. They say, okay, you know what? I'm going to go from, instead of going to the gym once a month, I'm going to start going to the gym 3 times a week. And then you're setting yourself up for disappointment, because that's very difficult. That's a very big and difficult adjustment to make. And if you don't achieve that, you're probably going to feel worse about what you did achieve. So I always tell people, just do a little bit more than you are now. If right now all you have time for and all you're really doing is, let's say you walk your dog once a day for 10 minutes, how about extending that walk to 20 minutes? How about, you know, maybe it just, whatever's the simplest and smallest augmentation to your current exercise regimen, you will feel better because you are thereby doing more and you're not setting your expectations up for failure and disappointment. So, you know, and theoretically, physiologically, if you do increase your exercise output by even a small amount, you should theoretically feel a bit better, because as anyone who has ever exercised knows, we feel good after we exercise. And it's also, of course, scientifically, there's a lot of evidence that it's fantastic for mood. And those studies on yoga that I was talking about before are one piece of evidence for that. So I really like that piece of advice. I appreciate that you asked me about it.
And is there anything you can tell us about the brain in terms of that little bit more?
It depends on what you're doing. I mean, It's always good to challenge your brain. Of course, the brain is not a muscle, but I like to describe it as a muscle because it's just like, any of your other muscles. If you work out, like you said, you're adding 5 kg to your whatever your bar you're lifting, like, okay, now your muscles are going to get a little bit stronger. They're going to adjust. And it's pretty similar to how a muscle works too. Because the reason that your muscles, and I'm sure you, of course, you know this, but for everyone listening, the reason that when you exercise, your muscles get bigger is because you're telling your body, hey, I need to be able to lift this type of weight in the future. And your body's saying, okay, let me adjust and pack on more muscle so that I can more effectively lift that weight. And the brain is very similar. If you're telling your brain that, hey, every day I need to solve a crossword puzzle and, navigate through a place I've never been and this and that, all these complicated cognitive tasks. And, I'm also doing exercise and stuff. You're training your brain to become more powerful and it will adjust accordingly. Whereas if you're stagnant and you're not feeding your brain activities, or exercising your brain, just like a muscle will atrophy, your brain will, it depends on how old you are. It may atrophy if you're very old, but at least those abilities will atrophy because if you're not exercising the parts of your brain that engage in those activities, then those parts of your brain will become less functional. They will become less effective at doing those activities. And then therefore you will become worse at them. So by increasing and ramping up the level of output that you're doing on a physical level, on a cognitive level, whatever it is, you're training your brain to grow just like a muscle.
Yeah. It's like you don't use it, you lose it.
Right. Exactly.
And I remember like the first interaction I ever had, well, actually second, because I went to physio, we did a huge neuro component in university. But then the second time I really started to really think about the brain was a book by Dr. Daniel Amen. Have you ever heard of Dr. Daniel Amen? Like he did all these crazy brain studies. And one thing that really caught my attention was he was talking about how the brain can physically shrink in size or it can get bigger. And I was like, whoa. I mean, that's insane. And yeah, so obviously this concept of a little bit more is really just to build that neural real estate.
Yeah. And I guess I should add more brain volume doesn't necessarily, well, okay. If you increase your brain volume, it probably will have a good impact on you. But the whole idea, I'm all about debunking misinformation and stuff like that.
Go so, for it.
Idea that, like someone, if someone has a larger brain than you, doesn't necessarily mean that they will be smarter than you. Just wanted to throw that in.
I like that. I like that because I've got a small head. So I'm very happy you said that.
I do too. One time I saw my own brain scan and I was like, wow, this thing is terrible. This is just a tiny little brain. My head's pretty small. But I wanted to say something else about the whole use it or lose it thing. As we age, when we reach advanced ages, the brain does naturally begin to shrink. And this happens very slowly, but it does happen naturally. And along with that, we see natural cognitive decline. And not to throw my grandmother under the bus here. I know she won't be listening to this podcast because I don't think she has a cell phone, but I'm seeing the natural cognitive decline in her. And it's funny because she's pretty sharp and she's very capable of doing the things that she does all the time, but she lives alone. And so she doesn't engage in much social interaction or, certainly that she doesn't interact with her neighbors. She doesn't speak very much. And while she's retaining a lot of her other abilities, she's suddenly forgetting a lot of words. And it's kind of funny to me because there might be other factors involved. There probably are, but this is a demonstration of use it or lose it. Naturally with age, the brain begins to atrophy and the parts that she's not using atrophy the most robustly. And so the parts that she's not using happen to be the language areas where she's not really interacting with people. And as a result, suddenly she's really having a hard time coming up with words and communicating. And, for anyone, of course, for those that are aging and worry about cognitive decline, but also for anyone at any age who's interested in just brain health in general, again, use it or lose it. You won't lose it if you're young in that sense that the brain will actually atrophy, but you will become poorer at abilities that you don't exercise. So, I always tell people to diversify the exercises that they give their brain. If you're just doing Sudoku puzzles, your brain will be really good at Sudoku puzzles, but that may not necessarily generalize to other tasks. If you're working on crosswords, you know, you might become better at word recognition, but you may not become better at Sudoku puzzles. So, you know, do all sorts of different things, exercise your brain in many different ways. And that's going to kind of retain a bunch of different areas rather than just honing in on one specific function.
You've already sort of touched upon the importance of social interactions, which I'm very glad you mentioned. It's something that I think we don't kind of emphasize enough how important it is for our general health. Please expand on that and also give us some other tips on how to ensure our brain health.
Yeah, social interaction is a very good one. I happen to study social interaction. It's one of the things that that has always stuck with me in another thing that originally got me interested in neuroscience. It's pretty remarkable how powerful interaction is and how healthy it is for the brain, and how poorly the brain does without social interaction. So, you know, I think we all experienced this a bit in the early days of COVID, and for some more than others, you know, the lockdowns were different lengths across various places throughout the globe. But we all sort of experienced that feeling, you know, whatever it was. It may have expressed differently in some people than others. And maybe for some it was, you know, a frustration and aggression and anger. For others, it may have been anxiety. You know, I'm sure there's also the problem that we were also experiencing a pandemic, which was frightening for many. But, you know, I think that there is a long-lasting impact of that type of isolation at any age. And some of us are probably still feeling it. And just engaging in interaction as frequently as feels comfortable for you, I suppose, is always going to be healthy for your brain, especially in old age. I think that's very, very important, because those two things seem to go together, unfortunately, is as you age, you become more isolated.
It's so sad. But I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I was just thinking of what you said earlier with adding a little bit more. Maybe that's like, since you've said those words to me and they've been in my head about exercise and maybe a couple of other things, I was like, okay, well, maybe we could apply that to something like social interactions. Now that we've got the data to prove how important it is, maybe as we get older, we should force ourselves. Okay, I saw one friend last week, I'm going to see two this week.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I think that it's always good to do more as long as it's what you want. You know, some people are naturally introverted. They don't enjoy interaction as much as others, you know, and that's the thing I'm really interested in, is how the reward system interfaces with the social systems. And it seems to be a little bit different for everyone. But yeah, it's funny, you know, I've always thought it was interesting that you could look around any given room and just see people interacting in different ways, you know, some in large groups and some in small groups and some people alone. And everyone has kind of found their homeostatic set point of interaction, you know, what makes them comfortable, what makes them happy. And, you know, I think you may not know your set point, but maybe after listening to this, take some time, sit down and think, you know, okay, how much have I seen my friends, my family, my coworkers, you know, anyone else in the last month? Who am I not seeing enough of? You know, what brings me joy? Because social interaction is really kind of one of the rewards of life. You know, there are very many ways that we can find pleasure and reward in life, and interaction is one of them. And so the nice thing is it's free and you can get it anytime you want. And it's not addictive and it's not dangerous. So, you know, try to think about what your set point is and how you are currently living relative to that set point. And, you know, maybe you're spending too much interacting and it's actually stressing you out and you're not having enough time for yourself, or maybe you're on the other side and you're not getting enough. But whatever it is, you know, it's an easy thing to balance that people don't really think about that often. And it's very important for brain health.
Yeah, and it can be free, you know, seeing a friend is free. So it's an easy one. Are there any other really crucial things that our brain needs to stay healthy?
Everyone's heard it before, but sleep. So, you know,
I was hoping you'd say that.
Yeah, I mean, sleep, the main things are, like, everyone has heard them before. Sufficient sleep, healthy diet, exercise, and social interaction. Maybe social interaction is not the typical fourth one in that grouping. But yeah, sleep is so important. Get enough sleep. You know, it depends. Everybody's a little bit different. And there are some people out there who are able to get by on 5 or 6 hours of sleep.
It's so rare though. I mean, I always think that, and I always think if you did sleep a little more, you'd probably be even nicer to hang out with.
Absolutely. And this is another instance of just a little bit more. And also, shoot, I wish I knew the exact study. There is a study out there though that shows that people who get more sleep are perceived as more likable. So there's that benefit too. So even if—
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah. And I think about that a lot myself when like I'll have an interaction or, you know, a podcast like this and I didn't get enough sleep the night before. And I'm thinking, people aren't going to really like me that much.
No, not possible.
Kind of grumpy.
I get very grumpy. And so I can definitely attest to that. I am not as likable if I've not had good sleep. Okay, so we've got sleep, exercise, social interactions, healthy diets. Is there anything— I know that this is maybe not your field, so feel free to just skim over it, but is there anything like really, really, really important for food wise that maybe some people don't even know about? Like, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but pineapples, bromide, am I making this up?
That I'm not sure.
Okay. Never mind.
I'm not familiar with it, with the literature on that, but one thing that's definitely, seems to be really good are like omega-3s, like fish oil and stuff like that. And eating like salmon, things like that, and greens. Omegas seem to be like some of the most well studied and documented for brain preservation, I suppose, like healthy aging. And the nice thing about that is, I don't know about you, but I think salmon is delicious. So
yeah, I love salmon. So yeah, I'm super happy you said that. I mean, my other favorite is mackerel, which is also high in omega-3s. So glad you mentioned that. Earlier when you were talking about your nightmare that you had, I was almost thought, does that sounds a bit like a bad trip? And I also did want to touch upon psychedelic mushrooms. And I don't know if this is going to damage my career admitting this, but I believe that taking psychedelic mushrooms has made me a much nicer person. And actually, related to your field of study, made me more empathetic. Mm-hmm. It just made me see the world in a different way. And I almost became slightly evangelical about it. I started going around telling everyone they have to do mushrooms, which was probably— I gave my 85-year-old grandmother some mushrooms.
Did you get feedback on that?
She told me it was the best day of her life.
Wow. Did you do them alone?
No, we were all with her. And I said to her, look, I've got these chocolate mushrooms and they're funny mushrooms. And she was like, oh. And I was like, and I don't want to force you to do anything that you're not into, but just so you know, if you wanted to partake, it would be my pleasure to give these to you. And she was like, no, I really want them. Wow. And anyway, I wanted to ask you, because you recently did a conference on this and I was so excited when I saw that, because I was like, I just want to know everything.
Yeah. So the whole field of psychedelics is so fascinating and very hot. And it's a very hot topic. It's a bit controversial, but it makes for great conversation. So yeah, I was invited, luckily for me, I was very grateful to be invited to this conference in Iceland. It was the first psychedelics conference in Iceland. It's called Psychedelics as Medicine. And it was really, really cool. And I spoke about the research that I'm currently doing that I can't talk too much about because it's unpublished. Hopefully soon it'll be out. But I'm studying MDMA and empathy. And MDMA, for those who may have heard of it, is also known as ecstasy. That is sort of the party drug name for it. But yeah, I mean, psilocybin, like psychedelic mushrooms, MDMA, LSD, ketamine, all of these drugs are being explored for their therapeutic value for various conditions. And it's really interesting. And there's a lot of science being done trying to understand how they're working and what they're useful for. But certainly, I mean, anecdotally, like it seems like everyone you speak with who has tried, you know, one or more multiple of these drugs has just says, like what you said, that just like it was life altering, you know, perspective altering. And it's a whole interesting topic, because first off, if you try to compare any of these drugs to something that's on the market right now for psychiatric conditions, like an SSRI or, benzodiazepine, something like that, anxiolytic medication, it's completely different, because those medications, I mean, an SSRI, for example, you take it over time and it takes a few weeks to get started and you hardly have really perceptible effects. You know, your mood might improve, but you don't really notice, wow, oh my gosh, I could feel it flowing through my veins, you know, where something like psilocybin, you could definitely feel
it. You know.
It. Yeah.
You are very aware.
Yeah. And that presents a lot of unique challenges and questions for medicine, because is the experience required? You know, that's one of the key questions in the field right now is, for something like psilocybin, is it just that the drug itself goes in the brain and acts on a specific system that does something that relieves depression and anxiety? Or is it that the experience itself is critical, and, you know, the experience is a result of that action in the brain, the pharmacology? So you can't really dissociate the two, but maybe you can. And this is sort of like cannabis has been shown to relieve eye pressure, I believe. Don't quote me on this. This is something I learned years ago, but this is just an example. So like cannabis can relieve eye pressure if you smoke it. And so you might have people who have increased eye pressure and they want to relieve it, and they're 80 years old, but they don't want to get stoned. And so it would be useful if you could just isolate the piece that relieves the eye pressure without getting grandma high, you know?
I see and what you mean.
So
because some people have bad trips, because in my experience, and again, sorry if this is not founded, is that people, it's almost like psilocybin mushrooms makes you more of what you are. So if you're happy and relaxed and chilled, you'll just become more of that when you're on it. But people who actually have serious mental health issues, more of those mental health issues kind of come to the surface. But please correct me if that's infactual.
No, absolutely. That's right. I mean, there's a whole idea of set and setting, and the setting is your surroundings, you know, like where you are, and your set is your psychological sort of space, right? Where you are mentally. And so if you're in a terrible mood, you know, you're panicky, and then you're doing psilocybin at the grocery store and it's busy, like you're going to have a good trip. That's not going to be good. And like you said, I mean, that's tremendously important and noteworthy that it can really go either way. And the way psilocybin, this is important for people to know, the way that these drug trials are being done with things like psilocybin and MDMA and so forth, they're not just giving the people the drugs and saying, go home and take it on your couch and watch a movie, you know, and enjoy. They're bringing in, they're doing
monitoring them.
They're monitoring them before you even get the drug. There are a series of therapy sessions. You meet the therapist. You know they do a bunch of screenings to make sure that you're not predisposed to psychosis, because sometimes these drugs can induce psychosis if you're genetically predisposed. You're screened basically, and then the day that the experience actually happens, it's very sort of spiritual. You're given an eye mask. There's spiritual music playing, and you just kind of put on the eye mask, take the drug, and go internal. And you have this deep experience in the presence of a therapist. And if you start to feel like a bad trip is coming on, they're there to say, you are safe. We're here. We're protecting you. We're watching you, you know, close your eyes. And sometimes that happens where this ego dissolution occurs, where people basically feel like they no longer exist and they are just an entity out, you know, they're leaving their bodies. And so sometimes I've heard people say like, we will be protecting your body, you know, go wherever you need to go. And it's really just this incredibly unique and powerful type of experience. But it's important to note again, that it's very different from taking shrooms at a music festival, you know?
Of course. Yeah. But you know what? I mean, every time I've ever done shrooms, it's been spiritual. Even when I've been in my fits of laughter and I, you know, can't peel myself off the floor because I'm laughing so hard, there's been this, it's weird. It's not like, oh, I'm just here doing this because I want to escape reality. It's been like, I'm even more in touch with reality. And I'm even, I don't know. It's like you said, the disillusion of ego, you start to really see how you've merged with the other. And it's weird because that's kind of yoga philosophy, that we are all one. So I found that really profound and amazing.
Thanks for listening. That was part one of the show. Next week, I'll be releasing part two. Remember, if this episode was helpful at all, please do share, rate, and review.